Okay guys, this episode is sponsored by Podcorn. Podcorn is such an easy way to monetize your podcast, no matter whether you're big or only just starting out, and it's super easy to use. I signed up a few months ago and I've already had several sponsors. Once you sign up, you have a dashboard with a really easy to use interface and a list of sponsors. Once you've picked a company that you'd like to promote, you send them a proposal and wait to hear back. You are in complete control of who you advertise, when you advertise, and even how much you charge. You also have complete creative freedom, and you get the same security if you are a brand too. There's no cost to signing up, and you don't pay a penny until you find the right podcaster for you. You also have some control over what the advert says, and no advert will be released until you deem it to be perfect. With payments typically received within 24 hours of distribution, Podcorn was an absolute no-brainer for me, and I can't see any reason why you wouldn't want to sign up too. Head over to podcorn.com, that's podcorn.com, to find out more.
A judge in Miami today followed the jury's recommendation and sentenced Theodore Bundy to die in the electric chair for the murder of two co-eds.
Ted Bundy was executed for the murder of a 12-year-old girl in Florida back in 1978. Over the past few days before his death, he confessed to the brutal murders of 20 women in four states.
Hi M&Ms, welcome back to another episode of Murder and More. As always, I am your host, Kira. So the term serial killer didn't exist in the 1970s. And it wasn't until the mid to late 70s that the term serial killer came into existence, founded by Robert Ressler, an FBI agent with the Behavioral Analysis Unit. Despite the term not being used massively and only just coming into recognition in the 70s, that doesn't mean to say that there weren't lots of active serial killers in the 70s. Charles Manson formed Manson Family in 1967 and was convicted in 1971. The Son of Sam was active between 76 and 77. The Hillside Strangler was active between 1977 and 78. John Wayne Gacy, who is also known as the Killer Clown, was active 72 to 78. And then we have Ted Bundy, who was active between 1974 and 1978. Theodore Cowell was born on the 24th of November, 1946, to Eleanor Cowell, who liked to be known as Louise, at a home for unwed mothers in Burlington, Vermont, with the identity of his father never being confirmed. There's lots of discrepancies about who his father was. Some say that on the birth certificate it states a man named Lloyd Marshall, an Air Force veteran, was his father, but others claim that the father is simply listed as unknown. Louise claimed that she was seduced by a man called Jack Worthington, and that's who the King County Sheriff's Office have listed as Ted's father in their files. There's a lot of speculation that his father is actually also his grandfather, with several reports that Louise's violent father regularly abused her, but there's never been any evidence to corroborate this claim. For the first few years of Ted's life, he lived with his grandparents, his violent grandfather Samuel Cowell, and his grandmother, Eleanor Cowell, who raised him as their son, as back in those days, it wasn't accepted that a woman had a child out of wedlock, so naturally, they wanted to avoid the stigma that came with that. For years, not just Ted, but friends and family believed that Samuel and Eleanor were Ted's parents, and that Louise was his big sister, but it was eventually revealed that that was not the case. Ted gives various accounts of how he found out about this, to some saying that his cousin showed him his birth certificate, but telling others that he found it himself. For this, and because Louise failed to ever talk to Ted about his biological father, he held a lifelong resentment against his mother. The finding out of his real biological mother isn't all Ted recounts differently. In some interviews, he spoke warmly of his grandparents and spoke of how he identified with and respected his grandfather. However, in other interviews, he talks about how his grandfather was a tyrannical bully who hated blacks, Indians, Catholics, and Jews. He also claimed that Samuel beat his wife Eleanor, as well as the family dog, and once swung a neighbour's cat by the tail. He says of his grandfather, who once threw Louise's sister down the stairs for oversleeping, that he would speak loudly to people who couldn't be seen by others, and would fly into fits of rage, particularly when the subject of Ted's biological father was mentioned. Ted speaks so much differently of Eleanor, and described her as a timid and obedient woman. He also remembered that she underwent electroconvulsive therapy several times to treat depression, and towards the end of her life, Eleanor had a huge fear of leaving the house, now known as agoraphobia. With a family like Ted's, a violent, abusive grandfather, a grandmother with severe mental illness, a mother who had him out of wedlock, and initially identified as his sister for years, it's not completely impossible to see how this could mess up a child. Although, despite the amount of instability in his childhood, nothing will ever justify the person Theodore Cowell grew up to be. From a young age, he exhibited odd and disturbing behaviours, with Louise's sister Julia recalling an event where she woke up surrounded by knives from the kitchen, and a 3-year-old Ted stood by the bed, smiling. For unknown reasons, in 1950, Louise changed her name from Cowell to Nelson, and moved to Tacoma, Washington to live with her cousins. That's where Louise met Johnny Bundy in 1951 at an adult singles night at a Methodist church in Tacoma. The couple got married later on in 1951, and Johnny officially adopted Ted, who took on his last name and became Ted Bundy. Ted remained very distant from the family, which only increased when Louise and Johnny had 4 children of their own. Whilst Johnny desperately tried to include Ted and make him feel part of the family, Ted never took to Johnny, later describing him as a not very bright person who didn't make much money. Honestly, I wonder whether Ted actually put any effort into feeling like part of the family. He resented Louise for the fact that he never knew his father, and now he had another man who had adopted him, who was horribly trying to act like his father. I can imagine that Ted eventually came to resent Johnny for this. Ted graduated high school in 1965 and spent some time studying at different universities and working in several jobs. In 1974, Ted was studying at the Seattle University School of Law, and as far as anyone can piece together, this is where the story really begins. On the 4th of January, 18-year-old Karen Sparks, a University of Washington student, was attacked in her own bed. An unknown assailant had broken into her basement bedroom and bludgeoned her with a metal rod from her own bed frame, before sexually assaulting her with a weapon that penetrated her so deep that it damaged her internal organs. As a result of the brutal attack, Karen suffered from severe brain damage and lost all memory of the incident. She remained unconscious for 10 days but was lucky enough to survive the horrifying ordeal, although she was left with permanent physical and mental disabilities. Karen, who remained fairly silent about her ordeal at what we now know to be the hands of Ted Bundy, spoke on camera for the first time ever in the newest series to be released about the serial killer. Here, Karen recalls that horrendous night. Quote, "It was horrible. He came into my home, took a bed frame off of my bed and smashed my skull. And he probably used the same bed frame and smashed it into my vagina and into my bladder. My bladder was totally split." End quote. She goes on to tell the film crew that it took 20 hours for her roommate Bob to find her. She says, quote, "I wanted to keep quiet. I wanted to have my own life in privacy. Women like us, women that have been attacked, they keep their secrets to themselves. I don't know why. We're taught to get on with it." End quote. Linda Ann Healy was a beautiful, popular 21-year-old who was studying psychology at the University of Washington. Linda, who was described as being full of life and a talented musician, lived with five other students in a house outside of campus. She was a weather reporter for a local radio station and was known to be dedicated and responsible. The 31st of January 1974 was just like any other ordinary day for Linda. She woke up when her alarm went off at 5:30 a.m. She went to her job and reported on the weather, and then went off to classes. Later that evening, her and a few of her housemates went to a bar for a few beers, where she was described as being her usual self. She was lively, talkative, nothing seemed unusual. They got home, and one of her roommates recalls Linda coming into her room at about 11:30 that evening, wanted to talk. I know I love a good gossip and a catch-up one-on-one with a friend, so I imagine it was a fairly light-hearted conversation, you know, talking about boys or university work. The two chatted for about 30 minutes before Linda headed off to bed at about midnight, knowing she needed to sleep as her alarm was set for 5:30. She made her way to the basement where her bedroom was located. However, it wouldn't be until Linda's alarm went off on the Friday morning at 5:30 a.m. that her housemates realised that Linda wasn't in bed. This didn't concern them straight away. They just assumed that maybe she'd got up early and was already at work. No one really began worrying until the radio station phoned to inquire as to why Linda hadn't come into work that morning. Whilst this concerned her roommates ever so slightly, they still weren't concerned enough to phone the police and waited for Linda's father and brother, who had plans with her, to come over to the house that evening. As soon as they shared their concerns with Linda's family and told them that not only had Linda not made it to work, but she also hadn't shown up to any of her classes, they immediately knew something was wrong and called the police. When investigators searched Linda's room, her housemates instantly knew something was off. Her bed was made neatly. The made bed wasn't the only alarming thing police found in Linda's room. When they pulled back the covers on the bed, they noted that there were small amounts of blood on the pillow and the sheet. Additionally, they found a nightgown hung up in the wardrobe that had blood around the collar. Linda's housemates all said that they heard nothing unusual that night, however did note that Linda's backpack, house keys and a pillowcase were missing, and that the back door was open, which was highly unusual. There were some suggestions that potentially Ted was stalking Linda or had previous contact with her. One of her housemates recalls a few incidences where Linda noted a man acting strangely around her, and recalled another time where there was a man just standing outside the house. There also may be evidence to suggest that Ted knew of Linda and that she wasn't just a random target. He lived fairly close to where she did in Seattle, and they regularly shopped at the same grocery store, but there's no evidence to corroborate or refute these claims. Linda's mysterious disappearance baffled police and would continue to do so until her remains were found over a year later. After Linda Ann Healy's disappearance, girls in the Washington area began going missing fairly quickly, at a rate of about one per month in the early months of 1974. On the 12th of March, Donna Manson disappeared after she left her apartment to go to a jazz concert on campus at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, 60 miles southwest of Seattle. On the 17th of April, Susan Rancourt was walking to her dorm after a meeting on her campus at Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, 110 miles east-southwest of Seattle, but never arrived at her destination. On the 6th of May, Roberta Parks headed out to meet friends for coffee at the Activity Center on their campus at Oregon State University, but failed to show up. On the 1st of June, 22-year-old Brenda Ball disappeared from a tavern near Seattle Airport. Even though these girls seemingly vanished into thin air, there were some reported sightings. Two students who also studied at the Central Washington State College later came forward to say that three nights before Susan Rancourt disappeared, they were approached by a man with his arm in a sling, asking for their help with carrying some books to his Volkswagen Beetle. When Brenda Ball disappeared, she was last seen in a parking lot talking to a brown-haired man who had his arm in a sling. Under 2 weeks after Brenda Ball disappeared, Georgianne Hawkins, who was a University of Washington student, went missing on the 11th of June whilst walking down a fairly well-lit alley from her boyfriend's beta house to her sorority house at about midnight. Friends of Georgianne's said that they were really close and that she always told them, you know, where she was going, what she was doing. And as we hear in so many of these stories, it was highly unusual for Georgianne to just walk away without telling anyone. As with Brenda Ball and Susan Rancourt, witnesses came forward to say that they had seen a man in that same alley the night Georgianne disappeared. The witnesses recalled the sighting clearly, as the man was in a leg cast and using crutches, and is reported to have asked someone for help carrying his briefcase back to his Volkswagen Beetle. All of these disappearances happened within 6 months of each other and took place in various places in the west side of Washington and into North Oregon. As you can imagine, everyone became scared and overly cautious. Hitchhiking as good as stopped whilst this was going on. Whilst these disappearances were happening, Ted was working for the Seattle Crime Commission, where he worked on crimes against women, particularly rape, and wrote pamphlets about rape prevention. A year before the women began going missing, Ted had to study the issue of crimes against women and had to make suggestions to the police on how they could prevent rape and significantly reduce the number of incidences. This gave him access to lots of statistics and gave him a huge insight into what police did and didn't do. And he saw lots of places where someone could take advantage of the lack of consistency between jurisdictions. During his time working with the King County Police, Ted realised that they weren't yet sharing information across jurisdiction lines, which is how he was able to get away with his crimes for so long, because different police departments weren't connecting them. They were investigating them as separate cases, which ultimately was their downfall. I wonder if they had noticed the connection sooner, if they could have caught Ted earlier and saved some lives in the process. The 14th of July 1974 was a beautiful, sunny Sunday afternoon at Lake Sammamish State Park in Washington. There were thousands of people at the park that day. There were loads of events going on, and there were a huge number of young people, specifically young women. Because the park was so busy that day, because there were so many people around, everyone felt safe. Who would take someone in broad daylight among thousands of other people? Unfortunately, this safety would be compromised when, at some point that day, Denise Nasland and Janice Ott disappeared from the park. Bob Keppel and his partner were assigned to the case, and police's fears that there may be a serial killer in their midst only grew. They now had 8 women missing in and around Seattle, and they knew they had to act. They had to find the person who was taking these young women. They set up a task force which consisted of one female detective, Kathleen McChesney, with other male detectives. Kathleen was brought into the task force specifically to interview female witnesses. I guess at the time they felt the witnesses would be more comfortable talking to someone of the same sex. Witnesses saw a suspect approach both Denise and Janice that day. Some people at the park reported having been asked by a good-looking man with a cast on his arm for their help loading his sailboat onto his car in the parking lot behind the park. The witnesses provided enough information about this man, and police were able to draw a sketch. Denise's friends recalled that she was lying on the beach when she went to the restroom and the man with the cast approached her. Denise obviously didn't feel uncomfortable around the man and happily obliged. She went with him to help, and this was the last time Denise was ever seen alive. A few witnesses also observed Janice Ott on the beach being approached by the suspect, who was noted to be driving a brown Volkswagen Beetle. The witnesses recalled that Janice got up from the beach when people witnessed the man approach her, and they overheard them introduce themselves to each other, with Ted using his real name. The task force received thousands of calls and leads. Ted was spotted everywhere across Washington. But finally, police had something to go on. They partially knew who they were looking for, a man with brown hair whose name was Ted or Theodore, who was driving a brown Volkswagen Beetle. Although we know now that the car was an important figure in the capture of Ted Bundy, back then it was useless information as there were 42,000 Volkswagen Beetles in Washington in 1974. Undeterred, the task force started looking at suspects named Ted or Theodore who were driving that car and who were reported as being a bit strange. This helped narrow down the potential suspects to 100, and even though this is a much smaller number than 42,000, there just weren't enough resources to manage all this data in a timely manner, so everything moved fairly slowly. Whilst police were trying to narrow down the suspects and were traipsing through the 100 names they had, they weren't expecting their suspect to be handed to them on a plate. On the 8th of August 1974, they received a call on the tip line from a woman who told them that she was concerned about her boyfriend, Ted Bundy. He'd been behaving slightly out of character, and there had been a few incidences that the woman just couldn't explain away. Elizabeth Klepfer was interviewed by police, and she recounted a conversation she'd had with Ted, where he mentioned an incident where he followed a sorority girl. Elizabeth then told police that she found a bag of women's underwear and a bowl filled with house keys in his apartment, along with plaster of Paris and bandages. Now, I didn't know what plaster of Paris is, but it's typically used to make casts, which, as we know, Ted was famous for having his arms or legs in a cast. Another time, Elizabeth found a knife under the right front seat of his car. She also told police that on the evening Brenda Ball disappeared, Ted left hers earlier than usual, and the next day, he arrived late to her daughter's baptism. Whilst Elizabeth was slightly afraid of Ted, she couldn't be 100% certain that he was the man they were looking for. After all, no one wants to believe that the man they love could be involved in several disappearances. Police had obviously received tons of phone calls from women saying that they were worried that the killer is their boyfriend, but this Ted was the right age, he drove a Volkswagen Beetle, and he was familiar to the University of Washington district. They also managed to find information that Ted had actually been to Lake Sammamish Park the week before Denise and Janice went missing. They then worked to find out where Ted was when all the other girls went missing, and unsurprisingly, he had no alibi, and very quickly became their prime suspect. Finally, this case seemed to be moving forward. The police prepared a photo lineup to show the witnesses from Lake Sammamish Park. His picture was shown to 8 witnesses, and 7 of the 8 were positive that this was not the man they saw at the park that day talking to Denise and Janice. Obviously, this came as a huge shock, and I can imagine it felt like they'd taken 10 steps back. Now, they had no ID, no fingerprints, no eyewitnesses. There was absolutely nothing physical to connect Ted to any of these girls' disappearances. As a result of this, Ted wasn't brought in for any official interview. They had absolutely no cause to even interview him, let alone charge him with any crimes. As this huge lead led police nowhere and tips from the public started diminishing, the task force slowly ground to a halt. They had no evidence, no leads, no witnesses, and I'm sure a ton of other cases to investigate. But the task force wasn't the only thing that stopped. The disappearances seemed to stop too, which raised the question, had the mysterious Ted and his Volkswagen Beetle left the area? Had he maybe died? Why had he all of a sudden stopped taking these girls? Ultimately, police realised that the only way they were going to catch this predator was if he made a mistake in a future abduction. And we now know the answer to these questions. In September of 1974, Ted made the decision to move to Utah. He moved to Salt Lake City and began studying law at the University of Utah. Ted admitted in the confession tapes that whilst he loved Utah, his real motive for moving there was to avoid capture back in Washington, as he had the knowledge that police weren't sharing information across state lines. He obviously realised that he came too close to being caught in Washington and needed to get out of the area where he knew he could continue his reign of terror without being caught. Whilst Ted was trying hard to maintain a normal life in Salt Lake City, he just couldn't ignore his darker side. In the summer of 1974, Carol DeRonch was 18 years old, and she'd just graduated from college. She got a job at her local phone company. She'd not long bought a 74 Camaro, and she started dating a guy with a matching Camaro. Life was going great for Carol. She was living the dream. However, her life was about to become more like a nightmare. On the 8th of November 1974, Carol was bored. It was a Friday night and she didn't have much to do, so she drove to the mall. She parked under a light in the parking lot and walked into the mall. Carol recalled that as she was looking in a bookstore window, a man approached her and told her he was a police officer. He informed her that he'd found someone looking into her car and asked if she wanted to go out to the car with him to see if anything was missing. Naively, Carol agreed and went with the man to the car, and it was fairly obvious to her that nothing was missing. When the man kept leaning in closer to the car, Carol started to become slightly more suspicious of him. But when he told her that they were holding the guy down at the police station and asked if she had time to come down and fill out a complaint form against him, Carol obliged. Although she didn't agree straight away, she did ask the man for ID as she thought she could smell alcohol on him, but he showed her his police badge and that seemed to allay Carol's concerns. Carol got into the car with the man, a Volkswagen Bug which she thought slightly odd for a police officer, and he headed down a side street. This was when Carol really began to freak out. She didn't recognise this as a route to the police station. When she told the man, he pulled over onto the curb, grabbed her arm and got a handcuff onto one of her wrists. Carol recalls this horrifying moment and says that her whole life flashed in front of her eyes. The man pulled out a gun and threatened to blow her head off. Carol was adamant that this was not the way she was going to go. She was not going to allow herself to be taken by this man. She jumped out of the car and he followed with a crowbar. They fought on the side of the street until a car came in the other direction. Carol broke loose from the man, who she described as having beady, blank, lifeless eyes, and ran to the other car. She opened the door and jumped in, asking them to take her straight to the police station. Little did Carol know that he was so mad that she'd got away that the man drove somewhere else and killed another girl 4 hours later. Deborah Kent was attending a play at her brother's high school north of Salt Lake City when she left early, but she never made it to her car. When police arrived at the scene, they found a handcuff key in the parking lot. That key fit the handcuff the man had put on Carol. Amazingly, police now had a witness. On the 12th of January 1975, 23-year-old Karen Campbell disappeared from the Wildwood Inn. She was last seen sitting in front of the fire with her husband when she went back to their room to get a magazine. 36 days later, Karen's nude body was found 3 miles away from the resort. The coroner established that Karen had died 2 hours after the couple had dinner and that she had died as a result of blunt force trauma to the head. There had also been two other killings in Colorado. 26-year-old Julie Cunningham, who disappeared on the 15th of March 1975 whilst walking from her apartment to a dinner date with a friend, and 25-year-old Denise Oliverson, who disappeared on the 6th of April from Grand Junction in Colorado while she was riding her bike to her parents' house. On the 16th of August 1975, a highway patrol officer was in a residential area around Salt Lake City when he saw a Volkswagen Beetle driving with its lights off. When the officer, Bob Hayward, tried to stop the vehicle, the driver sped away and a chase ensued. The driver of the Volkswagen finally stopped and was arrested for failing to stop. When the officer searched the car, he found a gym bag, but what he would find inside would soon be realised to be Ted's kill kit. Inside the bag was a ski mask, an ice pick, strips of torn sheets, a pry bar, pantyhose, and handcuffs. At first, the officer thought this was a burglary kit, but he soon realised that the man matched the description of the person who had attempted to kidnap Carol Durunch. On the 2nd of October, Ted was put into a lineup, and Carol Durunch was asked if she recognised any of the men as the man who'd attempted to abduct her the previous year. Carol was able to identify Ted Bundy as the man impersonating the officer immediately. He was charged with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault. He stood trial for this in February 1976, where he was found guilty and sentenced to 1 to 15 years. On the 21st of October 1976, Ted was charged with the murder of Karen Campbell, and in January 1977, he was extradited to Aspen in order to stand trial for her murder. On the 7th of June that year, Ted was transferred to the county courthouse in Aspen for the preliminary hearing. He decided to act as his own lawyer, and during a brief break, asked to use the law library. This is when Ted escaped for the first time. For 6 days, Ted Bundy was a fugitive, living in the mountains and forests of Aspen. After 6 days of being on the run, Ted was cold, hungry, and in pain from a sprained ankle, an injury he'd injured after jumping out of the courthouse window. He stole a car and drove back into Aspen, where he was arrested. Back in jail in Colorado, you'd have thought Ted would have learned his lesson. But it was quite the opposite, in fact. Instead, Ted came up with a better, more elusive escape plan. He acquired the blueprints of the jail, and at night he sawed a hole in the ceiling of his cell. He lost about 35 pounds, which is about 2.5 stone, and on the evening of the 30th of December 1977, he climbed into the crawl space above his cell, broke into the chief jailer's apartment, changed into ordinary street clothes, and walked straight out of the front door. From Glenwood Springs, Ted made his way to Denver, then to Chicago, moved on to Michigan before finally arriving in Tallahassee, Florida. On the 15th of January 1978, Ted broke into the Chi Omega sorority house at Florida State University, where he bludgeoned 21-year-old Margaret Bowman to death with a piece of oak firewood. He then beat 20-year-old Lisa Levy to unconsciousness before sexually assaulting her. He then attacked Kathy Kleiner, who suffered a broken jaw, and Karen Chandler, who suffered a concussion, broken jaw, and loss of teeth. Thankfully, both Karen and Kathy survived the attacks. Ted left the sorority house and broke into the house of Florida State University student Cheryl Thomas, just 8 blocks from Chi Omega. While Cheryl survived the attack, she was left with permanent deafness and equilibrium. On the 8th of February, Ted moved on to Lake City in Florida, where he lured and murdered his youngest victim, 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. Her remains were found 7 weeks later, 35 miles away from where she was last seen. Ted was finally caught and arrested on the 12th of February. Ted stood trial for the Chi Omega murders and assaults in Miami in June 1979. He acted as his own defence lawyer, where he sabotaged his entire defence out of spite. At the trial, a Chi Omega sorority member testified and placed Ted Bundy in the vicinity of the sorority house that evening. 2 forensic odontologists were also able to confirm that it was Ted's bite marks that had been left on Lisa Levy's body. The jury deliberated for just 7 hours before finding Ted Bundy guilty on 2 counts of murder, 3 counts of attempted murder in the first degree, and 2 counts of burglary on the 24th of July 1979. The judge imposed 2 death sentences for the 2 counts of murder. 6 months later, in early 1980, Ted stood trial in Orlando for the abduction and murder of Kimberly Leach. The jury deliberated for 8 hours before again finding Ted Bundy guilty, and on the 10th of February 1980, he was sentenced to death by electrocution. So how many victims did Ted have, and how many were found? We know that Karen Sparks survived Ted's attack on the 4th of June 1974. Linda Ann Healy was Ted's second victim, with part of her remains being found on Taylor Mountain. On the 12th of March, Donna Manson became Ted's third victim. He claims her body was left on Taylor Mountain, but her remains have never been found. Susan Rancourt was Ted's next victim on the 17th of April. Part of her remains were discovered at Taylor Mountain in 1975. Roberta Parks and Brenda Ball's remains were also recovered from Taylor Mountain. George Ann Hawkins, Janice Ott, and Denise Naslin's remains were found in the Issaquah Mountains near Seattle. Some victims I haven't mentioned. 16-year-old Nancy Wilcox was strangled to death in Utah in 1974. Her body has never been found. Melissa Smith was murdered on the 18th of October, with her body being found 9 days later. Laura Ann Amy's body was found by hikers after being bludgeoned and raped on the 31st of October. The 8th of November is when Carol Durant escaped Ted's clutches, and he then went on to murder Deborah Kent, whose patella was found in Utah. We know Karen Campbell's body was found after being murdered on the 12th of January 1975. The bodies of Julie Cunningham, who disappeared on the 15th of March, Denise Oliverson, who went missing on the 6th of April, Lynette Culver, who was last seen on the 6th of May, and Susan Curtis, who disappeared on the 28th of June 1975, have never been located. Ted's final kills and attacks would come in 1978 at the Chi Omega sorority house, which I've already told you about.
One of the more bizarre chapters in recent American criminal history has come to an end. The end for Ted Bundy, a 42-year-old killer who left a trail of at least 20 murders from one end of the country to the other, came in the electric chair of Florida State Prison, an execution ordered after state and federal appeals were...
After many execution dates were set and many stays of execution were ordered, which spanned years, Ted Bundy was finally executed on the 24th of January 1989 at 7:16 a.m. This came 15 years after his first known murder and 9 years after his final conviction and death sentence. Ted was 42 years old at the time of his execution. He'd spent half of his adult life in prison and the other half reigning absolute terror over the United States. I dread to think how many more victims Ted Bundy would have claimed if he hadn't have been caught. But a part of me also wonders how many victims may have escaped Ted's clutches if police had been sharing information across jurisdiction lines. All of these are what-ifs that will never be answered. The only relief we can take is that there is at least one serial killer unable to hurt anyone ever again. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a rating and review, and Patreon to consider becoming a patron of Murder & More. To interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at Murder & More, Instagram at Murder & More Pod, and Facebook at Murder & More Podcast. To view the sources and pictures for this episode, head over to www.murderandmorepodcast.wordpress.com. Have a great week, and I'll see you all next week for another episode.